All right, counsel, we'll be glad to hear from you whenever you're ready. Mr. Crowns?
Yes, sir. Morning, Your Honor.
Morning.
May it please the court. It is the prosecution which has the responsibility of vindicating the society's interests in swift and certain justice. It is the prosecution which has the duty of implementing the constitutional guarantee of a speedy trial. It is also the prosecution which has ready access to the data concerning delay attributable.
All right, let's cut to the chase here, counsel. This is rather convoluted. I had to do a timeline on this one to figure out what was going on with this case. But basically, as I understand it, we have a situation where your client was originally arrested. The charges were later null-prossed.
Correct.
And then he was directly indicted by a grand jury. A trial ended a mistrial. He was then re-indicted on additional those charges as well. He went to trial again on those charges, plus he was indicted directly, as I understand, on some charges that had been earlier null processed. Is that correct?
I'm not exactly understanding the chronology. But I do have my timeline as well, Your Honor. I can tell the
court. Well, I think the point, I think for my purposes of my question, what it boils down to is your entire argument, as I understand it from the brief, is predicated on the statutory speedy trial and the constitutional speedy trial argument flowing from the original arrest. Is that correct? As opposed to the date of the indictment that
I can see that the date of the indictment, the original indictment, is the appropriate time for the beginning of calculating the length of time for the constitutional speedy trial argument. Yes.
Let's start with the statutory speedy trial argument.
Yes, and for the statutory speedy trial argument.
Wait a minute. I didn't quite understand exactly what you're conceding. You're conceding that your argument is based on the speedy trial running from the date of the original indictment or the original arrest warrant, that your argument rest on that premise.
Yes, Your Honor, that's because in this case the prosecution deliberately took advantage of the run-a-new principle in order to penalize the appellate's reliance on his legal right to the speedy trial.
Counsel, neither of your two assignments of error alleges error the granting of any of the null process. Is that correct?
No. Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. But my brief, I did specify that they objected.
Well, I'm asking about the assignment of error because that's what we're limited by.
Right.
And so if the granting of the null process wasn't challenged in the assignments of error under the law of the case doctrine, we have to assume that they were properly granted for proper purposes, don't we?
No, Your Honor.
Granted,
the null process was challenged, and that was raised during the constitution during the motion to dismiss for speedy trial.
No, I'm asking about your assignments of error. In neither assignments of error do I see a reference, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that the null process were improperly granted.
Your Honor, the improper grant of a null process or granting of a null process and the objection thereto is part of the due process argument under the constitutional speedy trial.
I don't think you're understanding Judge Russell's question. It seems to me, if I understand Judge Russell's point, which I think is the heart of this, your argument rests on the requirement that we conclude that there was some bad faith on the part of the Commonwealth in null-processing the charges, yet there was no objection made at the time and no issue raised at
the
time of the null process.
There was an objection made at the time of the null process.
But the question is, when you filed the appeal and you assign error to what the trial court did wrong,
correct, yeah.
At any point, the words null process don't appear in either assignment of error, as best I can tell.
No, the words null process do not appear specifically in the assignment of error.
And so we have to presume that anything that the trial court did that was not challenged is correct under the law of the case doctrine, don't we?
Correct, except for it was challenged, Your Honor. I didn't mention specifically the assignment of error.
It doesn't matter whether it was challenged in the trial court. That's not my question.
Right.
Where in the assignment of error do I see an allegation that the trial court erred in granting the null process?
the assignment of error says that the trial court erred in granting the in overruling the constitutional speedy trial argument, that that was denied and his due process rights were infringed upon. That argument was made. The assignment of error was specifically that the trial court erred in overruling that motion.
It seems to me that two different assignments there. Let's, you know, I'll try to deal with them separately, but with respect to the statutory speedy trial issue, the case law is pretty clear, it seems to me, that on a couple of points. One, a null pros terminates a prosecution. And then, and if the Commonwealth chooses to re-indict an individual thereafter, the speedy trial clock starts all over again. I think the case law is pretty clear on that point. So in terms of statutory speedy trial, as opposed to the constitutional, which I'm going to set aside for a moment, it seems to me that's a straight mathematical calculation. If, you know, beginning from the date of the latest, the indictment for which he actually went to trial, to the trial date, is there enough time counting against the Commonwealth to constitute a violation of your client's statutory right to a speedy trial? Isn't that the only calculus we do in a situation like that?
I can see that the statutory speedy trial argument is my weakest argument.
All right. Well, then let's turn to the constitutional speedy trial, because that seems to me requires bad faith on the part of the Commonwealth.
Yes.
And I know you assert bad faith, but what do you point to that suggests bad faith on their part? I mean, at least the reasons the Commonwealth gave on the record that the trial court was satisfied with don't suggest bad faith.
Certainly, Your Honor, I could get to that point. And I cite that in this case, the state took a course of action was the objective was clearly to penalize the reliance on the speedy trial right. On January, and I have my timeline here too, Your Honor, on January 15th, the trial court ordered the Commonwealth to produce exculpatory evidence before the January 27th, 2014 trial date on the first set of indictments. And that was for first degree murder, aggravated malicious wounding, use of a firearm and robbery, and conspiracy. Further, the appellant argued that the instant continuance and all future continuance should run against the Commonwealth for delay in discovery production. The trial court found and ordered the same. That motion and that order was adopted by the trial court in the third set of indictments.
For what we'll call the third trial, the order is adopted, but of course it's still within the breast of the trial court, so the trial court's not bound by its own orders. I mean, it can change them at any time, can't it?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
So even if it didn't comply with that first order, if it charged continuances to your client or delays to your client based on sufficient evidence to charge them to your client, what difference does it make that there was an
originally an order? I agree with that, Your Honor. I think the trial court in the third set of indictments could certainly find a continuance against the defendant.
And then setting aside the null process issue, on page 25 and 26 of the Commonwealth's brief, they go through a listing on the third set of indictments of the various delays and who they're attributable to and list the ones that they claim are attributable to your client. Do you disagree with any of those characterizations?
No, Your Honor, I disagree with their beginning of the clock at the beginning of the third set of indictments.
I understand that, but if we accept that it starts at the third set of indictments, you will agree that only 112 days out of the 489 are chargeable to the Commonwealth.
If you agree that it starts at the third set of indictments, but in a constitutional speedy trial argument, it begins when...
Well, you're mixing apples and oranges, it seems to me. The constitutional speedy trial, there's no specific...
Correct. Yes.
And it's, you know, it's sort of a you know it when you see it kind of analysis the U.S. Supreme Court has done. And certainly delay in indictment, U.S. Supreme Court has held, can violate speedy trial, but it requires a clear showing of bad faith and also prejudice on the part of the defense.
Now, and I can show that.
I didn't ask you this earlier. I suspect Ms. Johnson's going to be the first words out of her mouth, but how do you deal with the alleged procedural default by due to the failure to file one of the transcripts in a timely fashion? How do we even address any of the rationale for? I mean, we know what the dates of the indictments were and the dates of the trial, but given that we have a missing transcript, how do we address either of your speedy trial issues without?
Very briefly on the transcript. The transcript was not created. It actually didn't exist, and the transcript was not created until. August 31st. It was actually ordered on August 26th. This is why, part of the reason why I filed a motion to remand the case back to the trial court for purposes of correcting the order, which was also not present associated with that transcript. And so in the absence of an order, in the absence of a transcript, that is a clerical error, which I filed a motion to remand and have the and the court granted it to send it back for production of those orders. I also stated in the last paragraph of my motion to remand that this would allow the...
What's the status of that? I mean, we have two courts can't have jurisdiction over the case at the same time, so the case is either in this court or it's in the circuit court.
The Court of Appeals granted my motion to remand the the case back to the trial court.
For the specific purpose of the orders.
For the specific purpose of the orders.
But
and
nothing about the transcript.
Right.
In my motion to remand.
I mean, the question, I guess, is the transcript timely filed or not? Because if it's not, we can't consider it. The rule's pretty clear on that.
It is timely filed, Your Honor, because what the Commonwealth doesn't consider is that Rule 5A8 states that within 10 days after the transcript is filed, and in this case, the transcript was filed well after the date. And so the transcript can't become part of the record when it's not even in existence yet. And so
who bears the burden of having it ready to go by the appellate deadline, the appellant or the appellee?
It's the appellate, Your Honor, but that is why I filed a motion to remand the case back to the trial court. And then in the last paragraph of that motion,
did the trial court enter an order under 801-420? You referenced it to be a clerical error.
Correct.
So I assume that's at least an oblique reference to the Supreme Court's decision in Ballou. But in Ballou, the trial court actually entered an order pursuant to 801-428B declaring that the non-existent transcript was a clerical error and ordered it produced and made part of the record. Do we have anything like that here? Actual order declaring that the transcript is part of the record?
Well, we have the clerk who created the order on August 31st making it part of the record in the trial court. Mm-hmm. At that time, it was remanded back.
Did the trial judge enter an order saying it's part of the record?
I don't know that the trial judge entered an order saying it's part of the record, Your Honor, but when I asked the court to remand it back and then furnish the rest of the documents, and I did say, should the court grant appellate's request, it would enable the appellant the opportunity to timely supplement the apparent insufficient record, obviating the need to again file leave.
Well, the filing deadline for the transcript is triggered by the date of the final judgment in the trial court. So unless you've sought modification of that, it seems to me the 60-day filing requirement, you know, it's pretty draconian because it deprives us of, if it's not timely filed, it deprives us of the ability to consider it. And in some cases, it's not necessary to resolve the issue, but it seems to me in this case it clearly is.
Let me ask something. Your initial issue, which you haven't touched on, was that the indictments were not proper because there were arrest warrants on which your client was being held, and they were still active when the grand jury returned. Have you given up on that issue, or are you maintaining?
No, Your Honor, I haven't been able to get to that issue.
Well, let me ask you this. Does it make a difference if the arrest warrants, and let's just take the top one, the arrest warrant was for second-degree murder. The corresponding indictment that was returned, while that was still an active warrant on which the defendant was being held, the indictment was murder one. Does it make a difference if that is the case, or if the original warrant had charged the exact offense, murder one, that was returned by an indictment while the warrant was active?
Your Honor, my argument would be that unlike the case of Siebert, which cites Way, which was cited by the Attorney General, Siebert said that he was never arrested on any of the felonies for which he was ultimately tried. And to get to that point, murder falls under 18.232. There's no different statute between second and first degree murder. However, there is a great difference
between second degree murder and first degree murder, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Not unlike the difference between murder and capital murder, which were the facts of what?
That's
so
correct, Your Honor.
Doesn't it make a difference whether the offenses charged in the warrant on which the person is being held and the indictment that is returned while the warrant is active are the same?
It does, Your Honor, but in this case...
It does make a difference?
It does make a difference, but in this case it falls under the same statute, unlike capital murder, which falls under a different statute. Further,
but
there was a use of firearms.
The crime of murder... murder itself is a common law offense, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, and this falls under the same statute.
It's not a statutory offense. Isn't it a common law?
I will concede the point, Your Honor.
Counsel, I want you to finish answering Judge Bumgarner's question, but you've used up all your time. I'm going to give you a minute in rebuttal because we've asked you a lot of questions, but I want you to finish answering Judge Bumgarner's question.
Just that the use of the firearm in commission of an offense also was falling under the same statute. It was a charge that he was arrested for and indicted for as well. And so my argument would be that it falls
under
the same
statute.
Maybe you
know the difference. The warrants were not in any of the record that I could find. But did not the charges, use of a firearm in the commission of a felony, relate to the two felonies that were actually charged in those warrants, murder two and malicious wounding?
Yes, sir.
And didn't the warrants, then the indictments, the charge, is that the way the warrants actually read? Didn't they refer to the particular felonies that were charged in the warrants?
I believe that the warrants charged murder. I don't know if they specifically said second degree murder versus...
I need to know the specific wording. It's not in the record unless it's something that you can give me specifically. Okay, thank you.
May I ask for a little bit more time to address the...
We've got your brief. I'll give you some time. As I said, I'll give you a minute in rebuttal if you want to use it then. Ms. Johnson?
Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Victoria Johnson, and I'm here for the Commonwealth. I'd like to talk just briefly about the procedural issues in this case. As I raised in my brief, and as I believe the Court understands, that July 9th transcript is not timely filed, and I submit that it's necessary, at least for the Commonwealth's argument, because that's where the Commonwealth's attorney talks about the delays in the case being attributable to the delay in getting DNA evidence.
That transcript is not necessary for the 19-218 argument, though. It's just a speedy
trial.
That's
correct. It pertains to assignment of error, too. Furthermore, though, Your Honor, I think that the bigger procedural issue here is that there are no records for the second set of direct indictments in this case, which would be CR 14-185 through 06. I talk about that some in my brief. It's difficult to do the speedy trial analysis, particularly the constitutional speedy trial analysis, without those indictments or without any records at all for those cases, because there's no record of what happened during that time period.
Well, we know what the date of the indictments were.
We know that.
That he went to trial, and we know what the date of the trial was. Mm-hmm. And so we're talking about speedy trial, whether it's constitutional, statutory. You know, we know the dates of the beginning and the ending date that were involved. Now, with respect to the statutory speedy trial, it's, as I indicated earlier, it's just a straight mathematical computation, and there's a presumption of regularity, so it seems to be in the absence of a transcript,
we presume
the trial court, did what it's supposed to do. But with the constitutional...
With the constitutional, though, I can't defend against any kind of bad faith argument without knowing anything about that set of indictments.
And
the flip side of that is that...
Well, the flip side of it is that...
Burden.
I mean, the U.S. Supreme Court has held that delay in bringing the charges, mm-hmm. delay in the indictment, can be a speedy trial... violation, provided two things are present. One, bad faith on the part of the government, mm-hmm. and two, prejudice to the defense. So, I mean, are you suggesting that without the transcript we can't deal with that issue at all?
I think not the transcript, Your Honor. I mean, there's no records in the records from 14-185 and that subset of cases were not made part of the record on appeal. So there's nothing about those charges on appeal. I think that you can reach the issue, though, Judge. If you allowing that there's nothing in the record saying why those cases were null prossed, I think under the Duggins case, you don't assume that there was bad faith. I think that with the presumption of regularity, you know, you assume that it was good faith. And as far as the mathematical...
Conceptually. The gap in time could be so large that one could infer bad faith from it.
It could.
But when we're dealing with 460 days, given the Supreme Court has said holdings for up to over 2 years without it, doesn't automatically get you there. We're not in the land of that inference.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's what I'm trying to kind of defend against, is a notion that something can be inferred from there when there's just no records from that set of indictments.
Now, if I understand the record correctly, and I'm honestly, off the top of my head, I can't recall if this is part of the missing transcript or not, but there was an assertion of, a bold assertion of bad faith on the part of the Commonwealth, as I understood, an objection to at least one of the continuances. But was there ever any sort of assertion of, or showing of prejudice on the part of the defendant in the trial court level?
No, Your Honor. There was not. Now, there was a bold assertion of bad faith, but I believe that was dealt with below. The prosecutor told the court, and the court accepted this, that there was a delay in the DNA evidence. They went into some detail about they need to get a Google squad from someone, and that person wasn't available, and they had to do a capias or something I think he had a warrant or something. So there was some delay there, and then the state lab was also backed up. That's on the face of the record, and I believe that's in the missing transcript, the untimely file transcript, I guess we'd say. And I would like to point out, Judge, that, you know, the fact that the transcript wasn't prepared, I think that this would be a different record if the defendant had perhaps moved for an extension of time and tried to get the transcript filed timely in this court. But leaving that aside, I think the court understands my procedural arguments, and I'd like to talk about the merits, if that's agreeable to the court. Starting with I think the court understands my argument on the statutory speedy trial. I'd like to talk for a minute about the constitutional speedy trial, if that's agreeable. Turning to that, Your Honor, I think that Harris indicates that you count the constitutional time from the last set of indictments. I cited that in my brief. However, I think that my analysis pertains no matter what, even if we go back to the full 30 months. You know, here the Commonwealth had good cause, as we've discussed, for the delay. The reasons for the delay don't really count hard towards the Commonwealth.
A significant portion of the 30-day delay is not chargeable to the Commonwealth under any theory.
Under any theory. While the defendant did assert his right on August 7th, 2014, he did not reassert that right prior to the trial that actually ended in his conviction. And I submit here that the defendant doesn't really demonstrate any prejudice. He doesn't demonstrate that he was hampered by unavailable witnesses. He doesn't assert their faded memories at trial. Any criminal defendant who's under arrest and facing charges of this nature would have anxiety and stress. He doesn't assert that there's anything unusual about that. And his length of pretrial incarceration was not oppressive here. He was charged with multiple violent felonies, and the Commonwealth had an interest in pretrial incarceration to protect the public and to ensure against a flight risk, given the sentences that this defendant was facing. And I think that my statutory speedy trial argument is laid out in my brief. It's a lot of math. I think that the court understands it. And to Judge Bumgardner's question about whether it makes a difference given the charges between the original warrant and the indicted offenses, you know, I think that falls right under the Supreme Court's decision in Way. Here, there's a pretty good difference between first-degree murder and second-degree murder, and as the Commonwealth stated at the hearing, these indicted charges more closely fit the crimes that were alleged to have been committed.
Hypothetically, what would be a violation of 19.2.218 that would, if anything, could anything ever require dismissal of subsequently obtained indictments? Is there a possible violation of 19.2.218, or is it a statute that seems to give you something, but it's worthless?
Well, I think that we had that violation in Triplett, where someone was tried on, I hope that I get the facts right, he was tried on a warrant without waiving his right to preliminary hearing, without receiving a preliminary hearing, and without a direct indictment.
Right, but the portion about it that talks about that no indictment shall issue if you're being held on the warrant, is that just...
Well, I think
aspirational?
Could it ever be violated?
Is there an exclusionary remedy, I guess?
Is there an exclusionary remedy? I think that I addressed that on the brief. I think that the statute means that you get a preliminary hearing on those charges unless they're supplanted by another charge. So here we had a defendant who went into the preliminary hearing, and the Commonwealth said, "No, we're null-prossing, and we've already re-indicted."
But those charges went away. Okay.
I think that's the answer.
Well, in this case, there was the granting of the null-pross eventually, which, although if I understand the sequencing, came after the direct indictments.
Right.
If the trial court had not granted the initial null-pross of the warrants, what's the status then? Because then he's being held on arrest warrants, he's been denied a preliminary hearing, and he's got indictments, and poof, they didn't go away because the null process denied.
If they poof didn't go away, then he gets his preliminary hearing, and the Commonwealth has to elect what they're going to eventually wind up with, be it first-degree murder, second-degree murder, right, either before the trial or at the end of trial, I believe, this case. Did that answer the court's question? Does that make sense?
Did it sort of
make sense?
It scratched my curiosity enough.
Okay. I believe that I have said everything that I intended to. If the court has questions...
Well, just to follow up on Judge, yes. Judge Russell's point, I gather your position is essentially that the right to a speedy trial is triggered by the charging document, whatever it is, whether it's a warrant or an indictment. Not by the event. In other words, it's all controlled by whatever vehicle the Commonwealth elects to use to charge an individual with a crime, and then whatever happens to that, whether it results in a conviction or an acquittal or a dismissal or a null pross, you know, that terminates that particular.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, and in the absence of any double jeopardy implications, the Commonwealth is free to proceed with a new charging document, which would then start everything all over again, both constitutionally and statutorily, correct?
Yes, Your Honor, and I'm relying on the Supreme Court's case in Harris and also this case discussion in Moore, which talks about kind of the checks and balances on the Commonwealth's ability to null pross and the good cause requirement, and I believe also adopted the Fifth Circuit's language that a court essentially can't deny a prosecutor's motion to dismiss an indictment unless there's evidence showing that it would clearly deserve the public interest. And I realize that the assignments of error don't assign any error to the reason for granting the null pross applies in this case, but I think that in this case, there is good cause on the record. The Commonwealth was seeking DNA evidence. This was a complicated prosecution. There was a joinder motion that wound up not going anywhere as the case developed. It was a fairly complex crime scene. And the DNA evidence was ultimately relied upon by the defendant in his closing argument because his DNA wasn't found on the scene. And for those reasons, I would ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson.
Thank you.
Mr. Crownson, I said I'd give you a minute rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor. So here it's clear that the Commonwealth never intended to prosecute the appellant on these seven indictments, which charged discharging a firearm, which are inconsistent with the original charges. There is no good faith to prosecute those seven counts of discharging a firearm in lieu of murder.
Given robbery, what's not, given what's moving. Not in the record, how is that clear?
Your Honor, we see it in other parts of the record, in the Commonwealth's own motions, and with regard to the transcript, we do have briefs and an order from the court on those arguments. The record, therefore, suggests the Commonwealth abused the grand jury process and requested a null prosecution.
Well, how does it suggest that? How does it suggest abuse?
Because that is exactly what the appellant's counsel argued on March 10th when they during
just,
the jury.
I mean, just arguing it doesn't show it. In other words, hypothetically, let me give you this example. Hypothetically, if I'm the prosecutor and I move to null pros and I say, Your Honor, Commonwealth moves to null pros because we think we just don't have enough evidence at this point to proceed. Court grants the motion. Next week, I develop a witness, and now I think I do have enough evidence, and I indict your client.
Correct. The defendant is discharged.
Well, can I finish my question,
yes,
please?
Sir.
Now, is there bad faith on my part in those circumstances?
In those circumstances, no. But in this case, the first set of indictments was still pending, and the Commonwealth sought and obtained direct indictments on different charges on the same conduct. Therefore, the judicial slate was
How is that ipso facto bad faith?
In that case, there is no way the Commonwealth is going to prosecute those seven counts of discharging a firearm in lieu of murder, robbery, and aggravated malicious wounding.
Is it unusual for somebody to be arrested on warrants that lead to additional police investigation after the warrants have been served, leading to better information for the Commonwealth, and the Commonwealth makes a different charging decision based on the additional evidence developed? And that seems almost definitionally good faith and not bad faith to me.
That's not unusual, but in this case, the judicial slate was not wiped clean by, as your example, Judge Humphreys, where someone was the defendant is discharged from the prosecution and then re-indicted. Here, the original charges could not be treated as if they had never existed because they existed at the time of the
Were dropped. They were null pros. They went away. Were gone. Poof.
The null pros was used as an unconstitutional
weapon. We'll have to put proof in the opinion somewhere, I think, so.
And the lack of prosecutorial integrity in the null pros here and the run of new principle.
But you keep asserting a lack of integrity in a null pros. Tell us what points to a lack of integrity here.
When the Commonwealth is permitted to run anew on a significantly lesser included offense that it never intends to prosecute and then re-indicts when it does intend to prosecute, it effectively creates an unlimited continuance that eviscerates the right to speedy trial.
So your argument is, under these facts, there is no way that anybody could possibly envision there being a good faith reason for any of the Commonwealth's conduct.
Under these facts?
Because we don't have the transcript, so it has to be automatically, every single time, this is bad faith.
Well, that's exactly what appellant's counsel argued. He said, I think the Commonwealth's trying to null pros in order to re-indict, in order to hold Mr. Blaine in custody and start
the speedy trial. But that's not evidence, that's argument.
Well, the prejudice there, Your Honor, is the fact that the Commonwealth did this in response to failing to produce exculpatory evidence. And on the prejudice point, the DNA evidence was available and submitted on October 3rd, but the police department didn't wait until December 2nd to submit it. The ruling on January 15, 2014, states that and finds that as holding it against the Commonwealth. Further, there's the order on January 27, 2014, stating that there's outstanding discovery items still existing. There's also the order on February 18th, ordering the Commonwealth to produce certain sundry documents. And then there's the production on May 23rd of those documents, but notes that 59 through 69 were produced
I think we understand your argument, counsel. We're going to come down, Greek counsel, and then we'll take up the next case.